Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again this week. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about coming up over the next hour, including an in-depth look at pediatric liver transplants. We'll also find out about some new Washington University and Siteman Cancer Center research on breast cancer in young women. And we'll hear more about Elon Musk's new brain implant device designed to help treat ALS and Parkinson's patients. But first, let's start the show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, Fred, it's always my pleasure.
How's your week gone?
Good. Not much going on, just kind of catching up on different work and submitting my rank list this week. So as I mentioned, we did our interviews and I've submitted my list of 300 some odd people to say they want to be part of St. Louis University's residency program next year. I'm excited.
I saw some stories this past week about this place where they are raising pigs to eventually use their organs for human transplants. I wanted to pick your brain on that. What do you think about all the hope of more animal to human transplants in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating topic, Fred. And just to kind of give people the scope of the problem, there's, I think, well over 100,000 people in the United States alone waiting for a transplant for one reason or the other. The kind of the three most common you hear about in order of kind of decreasing frequency of how often they're done is kidney, liver, and heart. And you know, the kidney is probably the easiest organ to transplant. The one nice thing about a kidney transplant, or at least the wait to get a kidney transplant, is we have a way of kind of substituting the work of the kidneys in something called dialysis. So it's you know, what's nice about giving somebody with renal failure or kidney failure a transplant is they don't have to go to dialysis as much. They tend to do better and have a better kind of quality of life. Going below that, like with the liver, if you don't have a liver that's functioning, you die. The liver is incredibly essential, and there's just no way to substitute the work it does. When people have a bad enough liver, the only risk is, or the only way to kind of keep them from dying from that is giving a liver transplant. And the same goes for the heart too, obviously. So you know, there's a lot of people that you know are eligible for transplants, they'll never get it, and they'll succumb to the failure of that organ, which is tragic. So the whole idea is to have, you know, it seems kind of obvious that animal organs, particularly for mammals, that are very similar to humans, and you know, I think the leading candidates tend to be a pig or a cow, and having their organs kind of replace ours, if that's possible. And just to let people know, I mean, that's not out of the blue. So I think one of the big things where you see that now is valve replacements in the heart. Often those are what we call bioprosthetic valves, which means they come from biologic tissue, and more often than not, that's either a cow or a pig. So, it is done. The problem with larger things like an organ is even if you're replacing an organ, any organ in the body, our body's immune system is kind of built to rev up and treat that as a foreign object and try to get rid of it. You know, this is what they do to infections. It's what our body does to all kinds of different things. So we have to give medicine to anybody that receives an organ transplant to lower their immune system. And the issue basically with using, you know, organs from a different animal is that there's a stronger immune response, and our usual kind of cocktail of medicine we give is not really doing the trick, and so that the organs are quickly rejected. And when that happens, particularly in something like the liver or heart, the patient typically passes away. So this is a huge problem, but a huge area of interest. You know, most notably out of University of Alabama at Birmingham was a really kind of, I think, really fascinating study in a very macabre way. I'll explain it here in a second. It's incredibly creative, and I think they had to go through a lot of, I'm sure, ethical hurdles to kind of get this done. But, you know, the question with all this stuff, Fred, you and I talk about studies all the time, and I talk about good studies and bad studies and how those are set up. The big issue with patients that have kind of life-threatening illnesses that are kind of on the precipice of dying, you know, in the hospital or very close to, it's hard to kind of do high-quality research because, you know, just ethically, it's hard to kind of get the right approval for it, one, and then two, it's hard for people to be enrolled in studies and may try something new when they're kind of on death's door. It's just very, very problematic to study. So what Alabama did was they actually took patients that were declared brain dead. So what that means, you know, I know it sounds kind of like a weird concept to somebody that's not in medicine, but it basically means their brain is all the higher functions that our brain does. So our consciousness, our basic function of humanity is all died. And we have very accurate tests to determine that. But the brainstem, which basically keeps the basic mechanics of the body running, is still intact. So those patients are technically dead, but their hearts are still beating and they're still breathing, although often they have to be on a machine to help them. And what Birmingham did basically was transplant those patients, and again, getting approval of the family and you know, doing this as ethically as possible with animal organs, and then giving kind of a stronger cocktail of immunosuppression medicine, so medicines to reduce our immune system. And that stronger cocktail seemed to work. Now, this is only in a couple of patients or a handful of patients, so it's not like rigorous evidence that's going to change practice. But it certainly demonstrated that it probably will work, and I think starts to open that pathway for us to look at this at a broader scale. It's kind of like the first, you know, it's kind of the first step off the moon lander, or, you know, the kind of another step towards this. It's not earth shattering research, but it really does kind of say this might be possible. We can continue to look into this and try and experiment. And that's really cool. You know, I was on service last week, Fred, as we talked about, and you know, one of my patients had liver failure, and you know, and she is was not a candidate for getting a transplant, and those patients really only go one way, and we're unfortunately extremely used to it, particularly here at a place like SLU. So to give people better options, or where there's not a scarcity, would be lovely, frankly. So this is exciting. It's a really interesting study. You know, I think once they got over that ethical hurdle and kind of demonstrated that, I think it really is, you know, kind of an interesting way of looking at this problem. So it's kind of a cool study.
We're going to talk a lot more about transplants later on in this show, specifically liver transplants in kids. So keep listening for that. We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, what are you hearing about a product called Zyn? It's a nicotine pouch. And I think there's a lot of controversy about it right now.
Yeah, you know, Fred, this is something I'm just now becoming familiar with myself. My teenage children have not mentioned this at all, so I'm going to take that hopefully as a good thing, but who knows, if they're just not telling me anything, that's the other possibility. But what Zyn is basically it's another kind of replacement for classic tobacco products. So, you know, there's lots of different products out there to replace tobacco-based cigarettes. Zyn is basically a replacement for oral tobacco or tobacco pouches or whatever you want to call them. It's apparently a bit of nicotine with other flavors it's in kind of a container or some kind of packet that you put between your lip and your gums in order to absorb the nicotine. With the premise that it's safer. You know, I think this is a fairly new product. I think the controversy is about whether or not this should be regulated or what that looks like. It's on social media, particularly TikTok, which is, I think, a big driver of young adult and children behavior. So I, you know, there's the questions about that. I think just purely from a health standpoint about this, it does contain roughly the same amount of nicotine as other things are. And again, nicotine is a product of tobacco leaves, but when you ingest tobacco leaves, as I've told before, Fred, is there's a number of different carcinogens aside from just nicotine that can affect the body. So in that sense, it may be less bad than kind of classic tobacco products. I'm not really sure this is any good either, if that makes any sense. It probably has more nicotine, or it delivers probably more nicotine than you would from other means. You know, we've talked before, Fred, about caffeine and the effect it has, particularly in younger people. Nicotine is the same thing. It's got a strong stimulating effect and has a lot of effects that way. So I think there's certainly concern. You know, I think, you know, without kind of wading into the politics about this, which have gotten very strange, and I'm loath to talk about, particularly in this forum, Fred, because I won't be on it for very long, I assume. But, you know, I think it's interesting just to just point out to the audience that, you know, we do have the Federal Food and Drug Administration that regulates your prescription medications in terms of the consistency and quality fairly heavily, and is also involved with approving medicines that I can prescribe as a physician. But the vast majority of stuff not prescribed out there that you see at a health store or even something like Target or Walmart that has vitamin D or vitamin B or some other supplement or some other nutritional item, none of that is really regulated at all. So you may be getting something that says, for instance, it has 1,000 units of vitamin D. It can have anywhere from 100 to, say, 5,000 units of vitamin D. You know, and I'm just making those numbers up, but it just shows that there's a massive amount of variability, and none of this is at all regulated. And so, you know, it becomes problematic because, you know, as a simple example, let me say I want you to take vitamin D, which I'll probably never say to my patients, so that's a different story for a different time. But, you know, if they get it at a Walgreens or a Walmart or CVS or any other store that's out there, they're going to get a widely varied product. And I'm not saying that is or isn't a problem. I'm just saying that exists. And I think what we're buying is not what we're necessarily buying. Doing something like this in the hands of teenage kids that have maybe not the best decision-making capacity out there strikes me as just kind of a recipe for trouble, kind of similar to what we've had with vaping for the last 10 years. So it's there. I think it's something to do. It's something to keep eye on for your kids. I wouldn't call it safe. And I say it's probably better than tobacco products with the caveat that I'd rather, you know, somebody not consume any of this in the first place.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks so much for your insight. Really appreciate it each and every week.
Yeah, thank you, Fred, and congratulations again. I hear you've been inducted to the Media Hall of Fame of Missouri, so congratulations this week to you. It's quite an honor.
Thank you, Dr. Buchholz. Really appreciate it. If there's a Hall of Fame for radio doctors, you've got my vote.
Yeah, I don't think that's coming anytime soon. I don't even think there's not even a Hall of Fame for doctors anyway, so which is probably for the best. So I don't know what you have to do to get on there, and I'm not sure it's worth the effort.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot.
All right, Fred. Appreciate it as always.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll talk about pediatric liver transplants. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank.
LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
A Florissant family recently took to social media calling for help in getting a liver transplant. The one in need? Their six-month-old baby, Eden. KMOX's Olivia Moses talked with her parents, Sarah and Kevin Hernandez, who opened up to share what their life has been like since the diagnosis and how they're taking matters into their own hands. KMOX's Maria Kina has their story.
Eden was born in July 2023, and her parents describe her as a very happy baby, meeting all the milestones. At the hospital, she had nurses peeking their heads in often just to hear her laugh. Eden was diagnosed with biliary atresia at 2 months old. According to the National Institute of Health, one in every 12,000 babies are born with this disease. And without proper treatment, infants can develop cirrhosis within 6 months and liver failure within a year. Sarah says it started with Eden being jaundiced at 2 months old. And then they went in for a weight check and blood test.
And then the next day, he called us and said, hey, we need to go to Children's Hospital for further testing. And then it snowballed from there.
Following that, the doctors did what's called a Kasai procedure. This surgery can slow or sometimes prevent the risk of cirrhosis and liver failure. But even with this, about half the amount of babies with biliary atresia need a liver transplant by the age of two. Sarah says time is of the essence in these situations.
And they have to move quickly because the surgery is more successful the younger the baby is. Mm-hmm. And so even at 2 months old, that was actually on the later end of things. And so they were trying to speed it up.
The urgency of a transplant is measured by what's called PELDS, a PELD score. It's based on the disease itself and also advocacy from the doctor. While the parents waited for a liver, Eden's score sat at a 37 out of 40. Sarah says she tried to come to terms with the diagnosis in a different way.
I said, I want to practice like radical acceptance of this. I want to take it and just accept it. I'm not going to fight against it. I'm not going to say, you know, that I don't want to just fall into being pessimistic.
Eden's father, Kevin, was afraid.
I try to stay positive about it, but with medical things, bodies are weird and things could change so quick. So I constantly have that fear that, yeah, we could lose her and she may get too sick to where she won't be eligible for a liver.
At the start of the new year, Kevin and Sarah made an online post about Eden and her need for a donor.
For us and a lot of other people, you try to just do it on your own and you say, you know, like, I don't want to ask too much. Like, how do I ask for this? So the fact that it's been a really overwhelming response, and even like people who are like, I wish that I could.
And someone did. Eden received her liver transplant from a living donor, a cousin in the family, Nadia Hussein says.
Being able to do this for Eden to me is just, I mean, the highest honor. To me, it's one of the most important things I've ever done in my life.
Maria Kina, KMOX News.
We're talking now with Dr. Janice Stoll. Dr. Stoll is an associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology at Washington University School of Medicine. She specializes in liver disease in children and pediatric liver transplantation at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Dr. Stoll, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are Eden's doctor. Can you tell us about her case?
Sure. Eden is the most adorable little infant who came to us with neonatal jaundice, where kids are born and they have yellowing of their skin in their eyes. And over time, we ultimately diagnosed her with biliary atresia. Biliary atresia is a disease where over time, your bile ducts become scarred down and bile does not leave your liver appropriately. Because of this, her liver needed to have an operation when she was just an infant to try and improve the situation with bile flow, something called a Kasai portoenterostomy. This procedure typically happens for infants between 2 weeks of age and hopefully by 12 weeks of age. The earlier that we diagnose this, the better outcomes for our patients typically. However, there are some times, of course, where patients go on to develop more progressive liver disease after the Kasai procedure. And Eden was one of those infants who ended up having progressive liver disease and somewhat rapidly progressive liver disease, where she needed to be readmitted and listed on the liver transplant list at quite an early age. Her liver disease progressed so much that we needed to get her as high as possible on the liver transplant list to try and optimize her getting potentially a donor organ. And during that time, a living donor was identified to be a potential liver donor for Eden. And she was able to undergo that living donor liver transplant last week, and she is now recovering from that.
That's really great news. So let's talk a little bit more about Eden's case and some of the things you mentioned there. Are any of her symptoms common ones of liver disease in kids?
Well, biliary atresia is the number one reason for kids needing liver transplant. It is important for parents to note that if your baby is still jaundiced at 2 weeks of age, that they go and see their pediatrician and get a formal evaluation for that, potentially withdrawing blood to make sure that they don't have a liver disease that needs to be identified to see a liver doctor like myself.
What makes the liver unique as a transplant organ?
Well, the liver is a very impressive organ that can regrow with time. So we have the amazing opportunity for people to be able to donate a portion of their liver, and then that liver will regrow within 4 to 6 months to be back to the normal size. So that is something that's pretty incredible. We can also take a patient's organ from a deceased donor and split it to provide it to two separate patients, two separate recipients, which is also an incredible gift for them.
You were talking about the weight on the transplant list. Tell us about the PELDS score. What is a PELDS score and how does that work?
The PELDS score is made up of lab values that we take from the patients, and as well as when you are a young child, your growth and nutrition and age also factor in. And the score is, it puts you in a level, a category of risk for mortality for waiting on this list. So the higher the score means that you have a higher risk of morbidity and mortality while waiting on the liver transplant list. And then there are other categories that patients can be transplanted in, that is 1A and 1B. But by the score, the higher the score, that's the patients are kind of ranked this way on the UNOS list, awaiting their organs.
We're talking with Dr. Janice Stoll. Dr. Stoll is a Washington University Associate Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology. Let's talk about that waiting list. What are some of the struggles of families and patients on the transplant waiting list? There are thousands of people just waiting. Is there a problem with the system?
The system actually works well, in that the patients who are the sickest on the list are the ones that are getting the organs. However, patients do have to wait sometimes a significant period of time, sometimes up to a year or more, for getting an organ on the waiting list because there are so many patients waiting. Our kids face a particularly difficult challenge because they're young, and the kids who are less than 1 year of age have a higher risk of morbidity and mortality while waiting on this list. This is why living donation is such an important option for our patients. Currently, for children, only 15% of patients are receiving a living donor liver transplant. It's very important to have that option, if available to patients, so that if they are becoming sicker or at all having any struggles, that we have that option for patients for living donation. Also, our outcomes for living donor liver transplants for babies are better than actually if you receive a deceased living transplant donor organ.
Dr. Stoll, let's talk about some of the tension and worry that comes with being on a transplant list. And it doesn't simply end after a transplant. There's a lot of potential dangers following a transplant, right?
That is right. Obviously, with any significant surgery, there is risk for morbidity and even mortality with a big operation such as liver transplant. Our patients who after liver transplant do potentially develop things like rejection, need for other operations and procedures. But our outcomes are excellent for pediatric liver transplant right now. And so we really try to optimize these patients prior to transplant so that way they recover quicker after their big operation and we can get them back to their normal life with their families.
Dr. Stoll, what do you tell people that are considering donating an organ? Why is it so important?
There are many kids and adults on the transplant list right now who will have to wait a significant amount of time to get an available organ for them on the deceased donor list. If you're able to and you're a healthy adult who is willing to donate a portion of your liver or a kidney to a potential recipient, it is such an amazing opportunity for these patients and families. The amount of stress that they are under while waiting these organ transplants is incredible. So if you're a healthy adult and are willing to donate an organ, boy, it's such a gift of life and such a gift of hope for everybody on the list.
Dr. Stoll, anything else you want to bring up?
No, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about pediatric liver transplant. It's such a need, and our kids and our families go through so much stress. We think they're such heroes to have to go through all of that. So I appreciate you giving me the time to talk about pediatric liver transplant.
Dr. Stoll, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate your interview and what you do.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Janice Stoll is an associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology at Washington University School of Medicine. She's also a specialist in liver transplantation at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll find out about some new Washington University research on breast cancer and younger women. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
According to a new study led by researchers at Washington University School of Medicine, breast cancer rates are increasing among younger women. Senior study author, WashU and Siteman Cancer Center's Dr. Adetunji Toriola says the steady increase was seen in women under age 50. Dr. Toriola is here to talk with us about that. Dr. Toriola, thanks a lot for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So we hit the highlights here. What did your study find?
We found that breast cancer incidence is increasing among young women aged 20 to 49 years in the U.S., and the increase in breast cancer incidence is driven mainly by increases in estrogen receptor-positive tumors over the last few years. Interestingly, the incidence of tumors that do not have estrogen receptors are actually decreasing. But because the majority of the cancers are estrogen receptor-positive tumors, so the overall impact is that there is a massive increase in breast cancer incidence over the last few years. Also, we found out that between the ages of 20 and 39, Black women have an elevated risk of breast cancer compared to white women, a 53% increased risk, and between the ages of 30 and 39 as well, an elevated risk of about 15% additional risk. However, between the ages of 40 and 49, the increase in breast cancer risk among Black women is actually mitigated. So we do have varying patterns of increasing risk that really require an in-depth guide and in-depth research to understand the factors driving these differences in risk.
How was this study done?
We used data from this Surveillance Epidemiologic End Results Registry, which is a nationwide registry consisting of breast cancer cases from several states in the United States.
I know you said this deserves further study, but what do you think is the cause? Why do you think we're seeing this?
That's a great question. We think that there are differences and changes in several risk factor profiles that increase the risk of breast cancer. We're seeing differences in reproductive patterns or reproductive histories compared to previous years. We're seeing differences in lifestyle factors that drive breast cancer over the past few years. And we think it's a combination of all these factors that are coming together. But of course, there are also potentially other risk factors that we haven't been able to identify yet.
Do you think earlier screening is warranted?
That's a very important question. The current screening guidelines target women above 40, 45, but there may be an indication and a need to have targeted screening for specific women at higher risk below the age of 40. For instance, maybe Black women who have a family history of breast cancer, they may need to have more regular and frequent screening based on some of the findings that we saw.
We're talking with Dr. Adetunji Toriola. Dr. Toriola is a professor of surgery at WashU and co-leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Center at Siteman Cancer Center. He was the lead study author of this new report. Dr. Toriola, how can this study's results help doctors?
We think it helps doctors by helping them to inform the fact that, well, we still have a lot of work to do to reduce the risk of breast cancer, especially in young women. Doctors need to start having targeted discussion on preventing breast cancer among women who may have a high risk of developing the disease, especially maybe women who have a positive family history of breast cancer. There needs to be more discussion on what are the things that the women can do to reduce their risk of breast cancer. There may also be a need to start introducing screening at an earlier age among certain high-risk group of women.
You talked about prevention. What prevention advice do you have for younger women?
Well, for younger women, we know that physical activity and maintaining very adequate physical activity, 30 minutes of physical activity, four or five times a week is very helpful. Maintaining healthy weight over the life course is very helpful. Diets that are rich in fiber, that are low in, are also very, very helpful to prevent breast cancer.
Does delaying childbirth have anything to do with this?
Yes, studies have found that the longer a woman delays having a child, the breast cancer risk increases. And we also know that over the last few years, because of the changes in workplace, women are working more and more now, and there's a need potentially to delay childbirth in some women. So those are reproductive factors that have been found to increase the risk of breast cancer.
Dr. Toriola, what's the main takeaway from this message? What do you want women to walk away from this interview understanding?
We want them to be knowledgeable of the fact that they should take their breast health seriously. They need to be aware of risk factors that can increase breast cancer and mitigate those risk factors as much as possible. We want them to talk to their physicians if they think that they have a family history of breast cancer, as that may require them to start screening earlier. We want them to be aware and spread the message that there are several things that women can do to reduce their risk of breast cancer. There are several support groups that women can talk to on forming report groups and also reducing their risk. So the awareness is very, very important, and also taking active steps to reduce this risk and participating in activities that can reduce this risk. Dietary changes, lifestyle changes, all those things can help as well. Just talk to people who are knowledgeable and get more information.
And just to be clear, those risk factors would be what?
Some of those risk factors are sedentary lifestyle. So women need to increase their physical activity. Women need to maintain healthy weight. Women need to eat healthy. And women also need to go for their screening mammogram as at when due.
Dr. Toriola, thanks so much for your time today. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about our work.
Dr. Adetunji Toriola is a Washington University professor of surgery and co-leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Center at Siteman Cancer Center. Coming up next on Health Matters, we'll find out more about Elon Musk's new brain implant device. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature. Whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to, or the succulents that adorn our homes, nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to four lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through... You deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame...
Two more.
You deserve this ice cold reward. Modelo, the markable fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer on KMOX.
There's still a long way to go, but it's a start. That's how medical experts describe their reaction to Elon Musk, saying his startup Neuralink has implanted its brain chip into the first human patient. The device aims to build direct communication channels between the brain and computers, eventually hoping to treat disorders including ALS or Parkinson's. Once in full working condition, people will be able to control a computer with just their thoughts. CNN's John Berman found out more about that when he talked with Emily Mullen. Emily is a staff writer covering biotechnology for Wired magazine.
Neuralink has been working up to this for a number of years now. This is a big milestone for the company, which has been developing a brain-computer interface since its founding by Musk in 2016. We've seen over the years Neuralink doing these live-streamed demonstrations in which they have trotted out some pigs that have gotten its brain implant, and they've also implanted some monkeys. So now, yes, we do. It seems like the first patient has now received a Neuralink brain implant. Last year, Neuralink said that it received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to go ahead with a clinical trial in people to test its device. And then it also got approval from an independent ethics board at a hospital site to do this. So I think it's pretty likely that it has happened. We don't know many details beyond what Elon Musk has posted on the social media platform X. This person apparently got the implant on Sunday, is doing well. But of course, it's going to take some time before we know whether this actually works.
So you told us that Neuralink's not the first company to put chips in people's brains. So what's the difference here, Correct. And what's the promise for this technology long term?
Yeah, so actually brain-computer interfaces have been, researchers have been working on them now for several decades. And the initial ones, you know, were made by academic researchers. And really this has been a field kind of confined to the academic realm up until recently, really in the past couple of years since Neuralink was founded by Musk in 2016. There are now several companies that are racing to develop similar brain implants. And the goal is really to help people who are paralyzed, to give them back a little bit of independence that they've maybe lost. You know, being able to control a computer, send an email or a text to a friend or colleague. I mean, these are things that most of us take advantage of every day, but people who have lost the use of their limbs are not able to do this. So as you mentioned, yes, there are other players in this space now. There's one company, New York-based Synchron, that has implanted a couple of its devices in patients with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease who are paralyzed. And their brain implant is a little bit different. It's a stent-like implant that actually goes into the jugular vein. And so there's no actual brain surgery required. It's threaded up through the jugular vein and sits against the brain. But what's different here is, you know, Neuralink it's a Musk company, right? I mean, Musk has made a lot of buzz around brain-computer interfaces.
Mm-hmm. Emily Mullen is a staff writer for Wired Magazine. So what does CNN chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta think about this new brain chip device?
This is a device that would sit in a certain area of the brain. So that's the interface that we're talking about, the brain-computer interface. It's then connected to something that sits in the chest, which is essentially via Bluetooth, giving off signals to devices, a smartphone, a mouse, things like that. So the idea is then to connect that particular part of the brain via the device we just showed you to the environment, specifically some of these devices around them. The brain does cognition, it does sensation, it hears, it sees. This is motor. This is motor function that could potentially be restored to some extent for someone who doesn't have it because of ALS or quadriplegia. I think this is significant, but very early. I think people automatically anticipate that this is going to be some sort of device that can quickly share cognition. It's nowhere close to that.
CNN chief medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section, or you can download the Odyssey app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join me again next week for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature, whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes. Nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails. It's better
over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/AcrossAmerica.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.